something about our firm or about a client. We don't talk. Understand?
Of course, Mr. Lambert.
Good. We're very proud of you, Mitch. You'll make a great lawyer. And a very rich lawyer. See you Saturday. Mrs. Ida had a message for Mitch. Mr. Tolar needed him at once. He thanked her and raced down the stairs, down the hallway, past his office to the big one in the corner. There were now three secretaries digging and whispering to each other while the boss yelled into the telephone. Mitch found a safe spot in a chair by the door and watched the circus. The women pulled files and notebooks and mumbled in strange tongues among themselves. Occasionally, Avery would snap his fingers and point here and there, and they would jump like scared rabbits. After a few minutes, he slammed the phone down, again without saying goodbye. He glared at Mitch.
Sonny Capps again. The Chinese want $75 million, and he's agreed to pay it.
There will be 41 limited partners instead of 25. We have 20 days, or the deal is off. Two of the secretaries walked over to Mitch and handed him thick, expandable files. Can you handle it? Avery asked, almost with a sneer. The secretaries looked at him. Mitch grabbed the files and headed for the door. Of course I can handle it. Is that all?
It's enough. I don't want you to work on anything but that file between now and Saturday, understand?
Yes, boss. In his office, he removed the bar review materials, all 15 notebooks, and piled them in a corner. The Caps file was arranged neatly across the desk. He breathed deeply and began reading. There was a knock at the door. Who is it? Nina stuck her head through.
I hate to tell you this, but your new furniture is here.
He rubbed his temples and mumbled incoherently.
Perhaps you could work in the library for a couple of hours.
Perhaps. They repacked the Caps file and moved the 15 notebooks into the hall, where two large black men waited with a row of bulky cardboard boxes and an oriental rug. Nina followed him to the second floor library. I'm supposed to meet with Lamar Quinn at 2 to study for the bar exam. Call him and cancel. Tell him I'll explain later.
You have a 2 o'clock meeting with Gil Vaughn, she said.
Cancel that one, too.
He's a partner.
Cancel it. I'll make it up later.
It's not wise.
Just do as I say.
You're the boss.
Thank you. The paper hanger was a short, muscle-bound woman, advanced in years, but conditioned to hard work and superbly trained. For almost 40 years now, she explained to Abby, she had hung expensive paper in the finest homes in Memphis. She talked constantly, but wasted no motion. She cut precisely like a surgeon, then applied glue like an artist. While it dried, she removed her tape measure from her leather work belt and analyzed the remaining corner of the dining room. She mumbled numbers which Abby could not decipher. She gauged the length and height in 4 different places, then committed it all to memory. She ascended the stepladder and instructed Abby to hand her a roll of paper. It fit perfectly. She pressed it firmly to the wall and commented for the 100th time on how nice the paper was, how expensive, how long it would look good and last. She liked the color, too. It blended wonderfully with the curtains and the rug. Abby had long since grown tired of saying thanks. She nodded and looked at her watch. It was time to start dinner. When the wall was finished, Abby announced it was quitting time and asked her to return at 9 the next morning. The lady said certainly and began cleaning up her mess. She was being paid $12 an hour, cash, and was agreeable to almost anything. Abby admired the room. They would finish it tomorrow, and the wallpapering would be complete except for 2 bathrooms and the den. The painting was scheduled to begin next week. The glue from the paper and the wet lacquer from the mantle and the newness of the furniture combined for a wonderful fresh aroma. Just like a new house. Abby said goodbye to the paper hanger and went to the bedroom, where she undressed and lay across her bed. She called her husband, spoke briefly to Nina, and was told he was in a meeting and would be a while. Nina said he would call. Abby stretched her long, sore legs and rubbed her shoulders. The ceiling fan spun slowly above her. Mitch would be home, eventually. He would work 100 hours a week for a while, then cut back to 80. She could wait. She awoke an hour later and jumped from the bed. It was almost 6. Veal piccata. Veal piccata. She stepped into a pair of khaki walking shorts and slipped on a white polo. She ran to the kitchen, which was finished except for some paint and a set of curtains due in next week. She found the recipe in a pasta cookbook and arranged the ingredients neatly on the countertop. There had been little red meat in law school, maybe an occasional hamburger steak. When she cooked, it had been chicken this or chicken that. There had been a lot of sandwiches and hot dogs. But now, with all this sudden affluence, it was time to learn to cook. In the first week, she prepared something new every night, and they ate whenever he got home. She planned the meals, studied the cookbooks, experimented with the sauces. For no apparent reason, Mitch liked Italian food, and with spaghetti and pork cappellini, tried and perfected, it was time for veal piccata. She pounded the veal scallops with a mallet until they were thin enough, then laid them in flour seasoned with salt and pepper. She put a pan of water on the burner for the linguine. She poured a glass of Chablis and turned on the radio. She had called the office twice since lunch, and he had not found time to return the calls. She thought of calling again, but said no. It was his turn. Dinner would be fixed, and they would eat whenever he got home. The scallops were sautéed in hot oil for 3 minutes until the veal was tender, then removed. She poured the oil from the pan and added wine and lemon juice until it was boiling. She scraped and stirred the pan to thicken the sauce. She returned the veal to the pan and added mushrooms and artichokes and butter. She covered the pan and let it simmer. She fried bacon, sliced tomatoes, cooked linguine, and poured another glass of wine. By 7, dinner was ready. Bacon and tomato salad with tubatini, veal piccata, and garlic bread in the oven. He had not called. She took her wine to the patio and looked around the backyard. Hearsay ran from under the shrubs. Together they walked the length of the yard, surveying the Bermuda and stopping under the 2 large oaks. The remains of a long-abandoned treehouse were scattered among the middle branches of the largest oak. Initials were carved on its trunk. A piece of rope hung from the other. She found a rubber ball, threw it, and watched as the dog chased it. She listened for the phone through the kitchen window. It did not ring. Hearsay froze, then growled at something next door. Mr. Rice emerged from a row of perfectly trimmed box hedges around his patio. Sweat dripped from his nose and his cotton undershirt was soaked. He removed his green gloves and noticed Abby across the chain-link fence under her tree. He smiled. He looked at her brown legs and smiled. He wiped his forehead with a sweaty forearm and headed for the fence. "How are you?" he asked, breathing heavy. His thick gray hair dripped and clung to his scalp. "Just fine, Mr. Rice. How are you?" "Hot. Must be 100 degrees. Abby slowly walked to the fence to chat. She had caught his stares for a week now, but did not mind. He was at least 70 and probably harmless. Let him look. Plus, he was a living, breathing, sweating human who could talk and maintain a conversation to some degree. The paper hanger had been her only source of dialogue since Mitch left before dawn. "Your lawn looks great," she said. He wiped again and spat on the ground. Great? You call this great? This belongs in a magazine. I've never seen a putting green look this good. I deserve Garden of the Month, but they won't give it to me. Where's your husband?
At the office. He's working late.
It's almost 8. He must have left before sunup this morning. I take my walk at 6:30, and he's already gone. What's with him?
He likes to work.
If I had a wife like you, I'd stay at home. Couldn't make me leave.
Abby smiled at the compliment.
How is Mrs. Rice?
He frowned, then yanked a weed out of the fence.
Not too good, I'm afraid.
Not too good.
He looked away and bit his lip. Mrs. Rice was almost dead with cancer. There were no children. She had a year, the doctors said. A year at the most. They had removed most of her stomach, and the tumors were now in the lungs. She weighed 90 pounds and seldom left the bed. During their first visit across the fence, his eyes watered when he talked of her and of how he would be alone after 51 years.
No, they won't give me a Garden of the Month.
Wrong part of town. It always goes to those rich folks who hire yard boys to do all the work while they sit by the pool and sip daiquiris. It does look good, doesn't it?
It's incredible. How many times a week do you mow?
3 or 4. Depends on the rain. You want me to mow yours?
No, I want Mitch to mow it.
He ain't got time, seems like. I'll watch it. And if it needs a little trim, I'll come over.
Abby turned and looked at the kitchen window.
Do you hear the phone? She asked, walking away.
Mr. Rice pointed to his hearing aid. She said goodbye and ran to the house. The phone stopped when she lifted the receiver. It was 8:30, almost dark. She called the office, but no one answered. Maybe he was driving home. An hour before midnight, the phone rang. Except for it and the light snoring, the second floor office was without a sound. His feet were on the new desk, crossed at the ankles and numb from lack of circulation. The rest of the body slouched comfortably in the thick, leather executive chair. He slumped to one side and intermittently exhaled the sounds of a deep sleep. The caps file was strewn over the desk, and one formidable-looking document was held firmly against his stomach. His shoes were on the floor, next to the desk, next to a pile of documents from the caps file. An empty potato chip bag was between the shoes. After a dozen rings, he moved, then jumped at the phone. It was his wife.
"Why haven't you called?" she asked, coolly, yet with a slight touch of concern.
"I'm sorry. I fell asleep. What time is it?" He rubbed his eyes and focused on his watch.
11. I wish you would call."
"I did call. No one answered."
"When?"
"Between 8 and 9. Where were you?"
She did not answer. She waited.
"Are you coming home?"
"No, I need to work all night."
"All night? You can't work all night, Mitch."
"Of course I can work all night. Happens all the time around here. It's expected."
"I expected you home, Mitch. And the least you could have done was call. Dinner is still on the stove."
"I'm sorry. I'm up to my ears in deadlines, and I lost track of time. I apologize."
There was silence for a moment as she considered the apology.
"Will this become a habit, Mitch?"
"It might."
"I see.
When do you think you might be home?"
"Are you scared?"
"No, I'm not scared. I'm going to bed. I'll come in around 7 for a shower."
"That's nice. If I'm asleep, don't wake me."
She hung up.
He looked at the receiver, then put it in place. On the fifth floor, a security agent chuckled to himself.
"Don't wake me."
"That's good," he said, as he pushed a button on the computerized recorder. He punched three buttons and spoke into a small mic.
"Hey, Dutch, wake up down there."
Dutch woke up and leaned to the intercom.
"Yeah, what is it?"
"This is Marcus upstairs. I think our boy plans to stay all night."
"What's his problem?"
"Right now, it's his wife.
He forgot to call her, and she fixed a real nice supper."
"Ah, that's too bad. We've heard that before, ain't we?"
"Yeah. Every rookie does it the first week.
Anyway, he told her he ain't coming home till in the morning. So go back to sleep."
Marcus pushed some more buttons and returned to his magazine. Abby was waiting when the sun peeked between the oak trees. She sipped coffee and held the dog and listened to the quiet sounds of her neighborhood stirring to life. Sleep had been fitful. A hot shower had not eased the fatigue. She wore a white terry cloth bathrobe, one of his, and nothing else. Her hair was wet and pulled straight back. The car door slammed and the dog pointed inside the house. She heard him unlock the kitchen door, and moments later the sliding door to the patio opened. He laid his coat on a bench near the door and walked over to her. "Good morning," he said, then sat down across the wicker table. She gave him a fake smile. "Good morning to you."
"You're up early," he said, in an effort at friendliness.
It did not work. She smiled again and sipped her coffee. He breathed deeply and gazed across the yard.
"Still mad about last night, I see."
"Not really. I don't carry a grudge."
"I said I was sorry, and I meant it. I tried to call once."
"You could have called again." "Please, don't divorce me, Abby. I swear it will never happen again. Just don't leave me."
She managed a genuine grin.
"You look terrible," she said. "What's under the robe?"
"Nothing."
"Let's see."
"Why don't you take a nap? You look haggard."
"Thanks, but I've got a 9 o'clock meeting with Avery. And a 10 o'clock meeting with Avery."
"Are they trying to kill you the first week?"
"Yes, but they can't do it. I'm too much of a man." "Let's go take a shower."
"I've taken one."
"Naked?"
"Yes."
"Tell me about it.
Tell me every detail."
"If you'd come home at a decent hour, you wouldn't feel depraved."
"I'm sure it'll happen again, dear. There will be plenty of all-nighters.
You didn't complain in law school when I studied around the clock."
"It was different. I endured law school because I knew it would soon end.
But now you're a lawyer, and you will be for a long time.
Is this part of it? Will you always work 1,000 hours a week?"
"Abby, this is my first week."
"That's what worries me. It will only get worse."
"Sure it will. That's part of it, Abby. It's a cutthroat business, where the weak are eaten and the strong get rich. It's a marathon. He who endures wins the gold."
"And dies at the finish line."
"I don't believe this. We moved here a week ago, and you're already worried about my health."
She sipped the coffee and rubbed the dog. She was beautiful. With tired eyes, no makeup, and wet hair, she was beautiful. He stood, walked behind her, and kissed her on the cheek.
"I love you," he whispered. She clutched his hand on her shoulder.
"Go take a shower. I'll fix breakfast."
The table was arranged to perfection. Her grandmother's china was taken from the cabinet and used for the first time in the new home.
Candles were lit in silver candlesticks. Grapefruit juice was poured in the crystal tea glasses. Linen napkins that matched the tablecloth were folded on the plates. When he finished his shower and changed into a new Burberry Glen plaid, he walked to the dining room and whistled.
"What's the occasion?"
"It's a special breakfast for a special husband." He sat and admired the china. The food was warming in a covered silver dish.
"What did you cook?"
he asked, smacking his lips. She pointed, and he removed the lid. He stared at it. "What's this?" he asked, without looking at her.
"Veal piccata."
"Veal what?"
"Veal piccata."
He glanced at his watch. "I thought it was breakfast time. I cooked it for dinner last night, and I suggest you eat it."
"Veal piccata, for breakfast."
She grinned firmly and shook her head slightly. He looked again at the dish and, for a second or two, analyzed the situation. Finally, he said, "Smells good."
Chapter 8. Saturday morning. He slept in and didn't get to the office until 7. He didn't shave, wore jeans, an old button-down, no socks, and bass loafers. Law school attire. The CAPS agreement had been printed and reprinted late Friday. He made some further revisions, and Nina ran it again at 8 Friday night. He assumed she had little or no social life, so he didn't hesitate to ask her to work late. She said she didn't mind overtime, so he asked her to work Saturday morning. She arrived at 9, wearing a pair of jeans that would fit a nose guard. He handed her the agreement, all 206 pages, with his latest changes, and asked her to run it for the fourth time. He was to meet with Avery at 10. The office changed on Saturday. All of the associates were there, as well as most of the partners and a few of the secretaries. There were no clients, thus no dress code. There was enough denim to launch a cattle drive. No ties. Some of the preppier ones wore their finest starched duck heads with heavily starched button-downs and seemed to crackle when they walked. But the pressure was there, at least from Mitchell Y. McDear, the newest associate. He had canceled his bar review meetings on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and the 15 notebooks sat on the shelf, gathering dust and reminding him that he would indeed become the first member to flunk the bar exam. At 10, the fourth revision was complete, and Nina ceremoniously laid it on Mitch's desk and left for the coffee room. It had grown to 219 pages. He had read every word 4 times and researched the tax code provisions until they were memorized. He marched down the hall to his partner's office and laid it on the desk. A secretary was packing a mammoth briefcase while the boss talked on the phone.
"How many pages?" Avery asked when he hung up.
"Over 200.
"This is quite impressive.
How rough is it?"
"Not very. That's the fourth revision since yesterday morning. It's almost perfect."
"We'll see. I'll read it on the plane, then Caps will read it with a magnifying glass. If he finds one mistake, he'll raise hell for an hour and threaten not to pay."
"How many hours are in this?"
54 and a half since Wednesday.
"I know I've pushed, and I apologize. You've had a tough first week. But our clients sometimes push hard, and this won't be the last time we break our necks for someone who pays us $200 an hour. It's part of the business."
"I don't mind it. I'm behind on the bar review, but I can catch up."
"Is that little Hudson twerp giving you a hard time?"
"No.
If he does, let me know. He's only a 5-year man, and he enjoys playing professor. Thinks he's a real academic. I don't particularly like him."
"He's no problem." Avery placed the agreement in the briefcase. Where are the prospectus and other documents? I've done a very rough draft of each. You said we had 20 days.
We do, but let's get it done.
Caps starts demanding things long before their deadlines.
Are you working tomorrow?
I hadn't planned on it. In fact, my wife has sort of insisted we go to church.
Avery shook his head.
Wives can really get in the way, can't they? He said this without expecting a reply. Mitch did not respond.
Let's have Caps finished by next Saturday.
Fine, no problem, Mitch said. Have we discussed Coker Hanks? Avery asked while rummaging through a file.
No.
Here it is. Coker Hanks is a big general contractor out of Kansas City. Keeps about $100 million under contract all over the country. An outfit out of Denver called Holloway Brothers has offered to buy Coker Hanks. They want to swap some stock, some assets, some contracts, and throw in some cash. Pretty complicated deal. Familiarize yourself with a file and we'll discuss it Tuesday morning when I get back.
How much time do we have?
30 days. It was not quite as thick as the Caps file, but just as imposing.
30 days, Mitch mumbled.
The deal is worth $80 million and we'll rake off $200 grand in fees. Not a bad deal. Every time you look at that file, charge it for an hour. Work on it whenever you can. In fact, if the name Coker Hanks crosses your mind while you're driving to work, stick it for an hour. The sky's the limit on this one.
Avery relished the thought of a client who would pay regardless of the charges. Mitch said goodbye and returned to his office.
About the time the cocktails were finished, while they studied the wine list and listened to Oliver Lambert's comparison of the nuances, the subtleties, the distinctions of each of the French wines, about the time Mitch and Abby realized they would rather be home eating a pizza and watching TV, two men with the correct key entered the shiny black BMW in the parking lot of Justine's. They wore coats and ties and looked inconspicuous. They sped away innocently and drove across midtown to the new home of Mr. and Mrs. McDear. They parked the BMW where it belonged, in the carport. The driver produced another key, and the two entered the house. Hearsay was locked in a closet in the washroom. In the dark, a small leather attaché case was placed on the dining table. Thin, disposable rubber gloves were pulled and stretched over the hands, and each took a small flashlight.
"Do the phones first," one said.
They worked quickly, in the dark. The receiver from the kitchen phone was unplugged and laid on the table. The microphone was unscrewed and examined. A tiny drop-in transmitter, the size of a raisin, was glued in the cavity of the receiver and held firmly in place for 10 seconds. When the glue became firm, the microphone was replaced and the receiver was plugged into the phone and hung on the kitchen wall. The voices or signals would be transmitted to a small receiver to be installed in the attic. A larger transmitter next to the receiver would send the signals across town to an antenna on top of the Bendini building. Using the AC lines as a power source, the small bugs in the phones would transmit indefinitely.
Get the one in the den.
The attaché case was moved to a sofa. Above the recliner, they drove a small nail into a ridge in the paneling, then removed it. A thin black cylinder, 1/20 of an inch by 1 inch, was carefully placed in the hole. It was cemented in place with a dab of black epoxy. The microphone was invisible. A wire, the thickness of a human hair, was gently fitted into the seam of the paneling and run to the ceiling. It would be connected to a receiver in the attic. Identical mics were hidden in the walls of each bedroom. The men found the retractable stairs in the main hallway and climbed into the attic.
One removed the receiver and transmitter from the case while the other painstakingly pulled the tiny wires from the walls. When he gathered them, he wrapped them together and laid them under the insulation and ran them to a corner where his partner was placing the transmitter in an old cardboard box. An AC line was spliced and wired to the unit to provide power and transmission. A small antenna was raised to within an inch of the roof decking. Their breathing became heavier in the sweltering heat of the dark attic. The small plastic casing of an old radio was fitted around the transmitter, and they scattered insulation and old clothing around it. It was in a remote corner and not likely to be noticed for months, maybe years. And if it was noticed, it would appear to be only worthless junk. It could be picked up and thrown away without suspicion. They admired their handiwork for a second, then descended the stairs. They meticulously covered their tracks and were finished in 10 minutes. Hearsay was released from the closet and the men crept into the carport. They backed quickly out the driveway and sped into the night. As the baked pompano was served, the BMW parked quietly next to the restaurant. The driver fished through his pockets and found the key to a maroon Jaguar, property of Mr. Kendall Mahon, attorney at law. The two technicians locked the BMW and slid into the Jag. The Mahons lived much closer than the McDears, and judging from the floor plans, the job would be quicker. On the fifth floor of the Bendini building, Marcus stared at a panel of blinking lights and waited for some signal from 1231 East Meadowbrook. The dinner party had broken up 30 minutes earlier, and it was time to listen. A tiny yellow light flashed weakly, and he draped a headset over his ears. He pushed a button to record. He waited. A green light beside the code MCD6 began flashing. It was the bedroom wall. The signals grew clearer, voices at first faint, then very clear. He increased the volume and listened. "Jill Mahon is a bitch," the female, Mrs. McDear, was saying. "The more she drank, the bitchier she got." "I think she's a blue blood of some sort," Mr. McDear replied. "Her husband is okay, but she's a real snot," Mrs. McDear said. "Are you drunk?" asked Mr. McDear.
"Almost. I'm ready for passionate sex."
Marcus increased the volume and leaned toward the blinking lights. "Take your clothes off," demanded Mrs. McDear.
"We haven't done this in a while," said Mr. McDear.
Marcus stood and hovered above the switches and lights.
"And whose fault is that?" she asked.
"I haven't forgotten how."
"You're beautiful."
"Get in the bed," she said.
Marcus turned the dial marked volume until it would go no further. He smiled at the lights and breathed heavily. He loved these associates, fresh from law school and full of energy. He smiled at the sounds of their lovemaking. He closed his eyes and watched them.
Chapter 9.
The CAPS crisis passed in 2 weeks without disaster, thanks largely to a string of 18-hour days by the newest member of the firm, a member who had not yet passed the bar exam and who was too busy practicing law to worry about it. In July, he billed an average of 59 hours a week, a firm record for a non-lawyer. Avery proudly informed the partners at the monthly meeting that McDear's work was remarkable for a rookie. The CAPS deal was closed 3 days ahead of schedule, thanks to McDear. The documents totaled 400 pages, all perfect, all meticulously researched, drafted, and redrafted by McDear. Coker Hanks would close within a month, thanks to McDear, and the firm would earn close to a quarter of a mil. He was a machine. Oliver Lambert expressed concern over his study habits.
The bar exam was less than 3 weeks away, and it was obvious to all that McDear was not ready. He had canceled half his review sessions in July and had logged less than 20 hours. Avery said not to worry. His boy would be ready. 15 days before the exam, Mitch finally complained. He was about to flunk it, he explained to Avery over lunch at the Manhattan Club, and he needed time to study. Lots of time. He could cram it in for the next 2 weeks and pass by the hair of his ass, but he had to be left alone. No deadlines, no emergencies, no all-nighters. He pleaded. Avery listened carefully and apologized. He promised to ignore him for the next 2 weeks. Mitch said thanks. On the first Monday in August, a firm meeting was called in the main library on the first floor. It was the meeting room, the largest of the four libraries, the showplace. Half the lawyers sat around the antique cherry conference table with 20 chairs under it. The rest stood next to the shelves of thick leather law books, which had not been opened in decades. Every member was present, even Nathan Locke. He arrived late and stood next to the door by himself. He spoke to no one, and no one looked at him. Mitch stole a glance at black eyes when possible. The mood was somber. No smiles. Beth Kaczynski and Laura Hodge were escorted through the door by Oliver Lambert. They were seated at the front of the room, facing a wall where two veiled portraits hung. They held hands and tried to smile. Mr. Lambert stood with his back to the wall and faced the small audience. He spoke softly, his rich baritone exuding sympathy and compassion. He almost whispered at first, but the power of his voice made every sound and every syllable clear throughout the room. He looked at the two widows and told of the deep sadness the firm felt, how they would always be taken care of as long as there was a firm. He talked of Marty and Joe, of their first few years with the firm, of their importance to the firm, of the vast voids their deaths created. He spoke of their love for their families, their dedication to their homes. The man was eloquent. He spoke in prose with no forethought as to what the next sentence would be. The widows cried softly and wiped their eyes. And then some of the closer ones, Lamar Quinn and Doug Turney, began to sniffle. When he had said enough, he unveiled the portrait of Martin Kaczynski. It was an emotional moment. There were more tears. There would be a scholarship established at the Chicago Law School in his name. The firm would set up trusts for his children's education. The family would be taken care of. Beth bit her lip, but cried louder. The seasoned, hardened, tough-as-nails negotiators of the great Bendini firm swallowed rapidly and avoided looking at each other. Only Nathan Locke was unmoved. He glared at the wall with his penetrating lasers and ignored the ceremony. Then the portrait of Joe Hodge and a similar biography, similar scholarship and trust funds. Mitch had heard a rumor that Hodge purchased a $2 million life insurance policy 4 months before his death. When the eulogies were complete, Nathan Locke disappeared through the door. The lawyers surrounded the widows and offered quiet words and embraces. Mitch did not know them and had nothing to say. He walked to the front wall and examined the paintings. Next to those of Kaczynski and Hodge were three slightly smaller but equally dignified portraits. The one of the woman caught his attention. The brass plate read, Alice Noss, 1948 to 1977. She was a mistake, Avery said under his breath as he stepped next to his associate. What do you mean? Mitch asked.
Typical female lawyer. Came here from Harvard, number one in her class, and carrying a chip because she was a female. Thought every man alive was a sexist, and it was her mission in life to eliminate discrimination. Super bitch. After 6 months, we all hated her but couldn't get rid of her. She forced 2 partners into early retirement. Milligan still blames her for his heart attack. He was her partner.
Was she a good lawyer?
Very good. But it was impossible to appreciate her talents. She was so contentious about everything.
What happened to her?
Car wreck. Killed by a drunk driver. It was really tragic.
Was she the first woman?
Yes. And the last, unless we get sued.
Mitch nodded to the next portrait.
Who was he?
Robert Lamb.
He was a good friend of mine. Emory Law School in Atlanta. He was about 3 years ahead of me.
What happened?
No one knows. He was an avid hunter. We hunted moose in Wyoming one winter. In 1972, he was deer hunting in Arkansas and turned up missing. They found him a month later in a ravine with a hole through his head. Autopsy said the bullet entered through the rear of his skull and blew away most of his face. They speculate the shot was fired from a high-powered rifle at long range. It was probably an accident, but we'll never know. I could never imagine anyone wanting to kill Bobby Lamb.
The last portrait was of John Mickle, 1950 to 1984.
What happened to him? Mitch whispered. Probably the most tragic of all. He was not a strong man, and the pressure got to him. He drank a lot and started drugs. Then his wife left him, and they had a bitter divorce. The firm was embarrassed. After he had been here 10 years, he began to fear he would not become a partner. The drinking got worse. We spent a small fortune on treatment, shrinks, everything. But nothing worked. He became depressed, then suicidal. He wrote a 7-page suicide note and blew his brains out.
That's terrible.
Sure was.
Where'd they find him?
Avery cleared his throat and glanced around the room. In your office.
What?
Yeah, but they cleaned it up.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious. It was years ago, and the office has been used since then. It's okay. Mitch was speechless.
You're not superstitious, are you? Avery asked with a nasty grin.
Of course not. I guess I should have told you, but it's not something we talk about.
Can I change offices?
Sure. Just flunk the bar exam, and we'll give you one of those paralegal offices in the basement. If I flunk it, it'll be because of you.
Yes, but you won't flunk it, will you?
If you can pass it, so can I. From 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., the Bendini building was empty and quiet. Nathan Locke arrived around 6, but went straight to his office and locked the door. At 7, the associates began appearing and voices could be heard. By 7:30, the firm had a quorum and a handful of secretaries punched in. By 8, the halls were full and it was chaos as usual. Concentration became difficult. Interruptions were routine. Phones beeped incessantly. By 9, all lawyers, paralegals, clerks, and secretaries were either present or accounted for. Mitch treasured the solitude of the early hours. He moved his clock up 30 minutes and began waking Dutch at 5 instead of 5:30. After making 2 pots of coffee, he roamed the dark halls, flipping light switches and inspecting the building. Occasionally, on a clear morning, he would stand before the window in Lamar's office and watch the dawn break over the mighty Mississippi below.
He would count the barges lined neatly before their tugboats plowing slowly upriver. He watched the trucks inch across the bridge in the distance. But he wasted little time. He dictated letters, briefs, summaries, memorandums, and 100 other documents for Nina to type and Avery to review. He crammed for the bar exam. The morning after the ceremony for the dead lawyers, he found himself in the library on the first floor looking for a treatise when he again noticed the 5 portraits. He walked to the wall and stared at them, remembering the brief obituaries given by Avery. 5 dead lawyers in 20 years. It was a dangerous place to work. On a legal pad, he scribbled their names and the years they died. It was 5:30. Something moved in the hallway, and he jerked to his right. In the darkness, he saw black eyes watching. He stepped forward to the door and glared at Mitch. "What are you doing?" he demanded. Mitch faced him and attempted a smile. "Good morning to you. It happens I am studying for the bar exam." Locke glanced at the portraits and then stared at Mitch. "I see. Why are you so interested in them?" "Just curious. This firm has had its share of tragedy." "They're all dead. A real tragedy will occur if you don't pass the bar exam." "I intend to pass it." "I've heard otherwise. Your study habits are causing concern among the partners." "Are the partners concerned about my excessive billing?" "Don't get smart. You were told the bar exam has priority over everything. An employee with no license is of no use to this firm." Mitch thought of a dozen smart retorts, but let it pass. Locke stepped backward and disappeared. In his office, with the door closed, Mitch hid the names and dates in a drawer and opened a review book on constitutional law. Chapter 10. The Saturday after the bar exam, Mitch avoided his office and his house and spent the morning digging in the flower beds and waiting. With the remodeling complete, the house was now presentable. And, of course, the first guests had to be her parents. Abby had cleaned and polished for a week, and it was now time. She promised they wouldn't stay long, no more than a few hours. He promised to be as nice as possible. Mitch had washed and waxed both new cars, and they looked as if they had just left the showroom. The lawn had been manicured by a kid down the street. Mr. Rice had applied fertilizer for a month, and it looked like a puttin' green, as he liked to say. At noon, they arrived, and he reluctantly left the flower beds. He smiled and greeted them and excused himself to go clean up. He could tell they were uncomfortable, and he wanted it that way. He took a long shower as Abby showed them every piece of furniture and every inch of wallpaper. These things impressed the Sutherlands. Small things always did. They dwelt on the things others did or did not have. He was the president of a small county bank that had been on the verge of collapse for 10 years. She was too good to work and had spent all of her adult life seeking social advancement in a town where there was none to be had. She had traced her ancestry to royalty in one of the old countries, and this had always impressed the coal miners in Danesboro, Kentucky. With so much blue blood in her veins, it had fallen her duty to do nothing but drink hot tea, play bridge, talk of her husband's money, condemn the less fortunate, and work tirelessly in the garden club. He was a stuffed shirt who jumped when she barked and lived in eternal fear of making her mad. As a team, they had relentlessly pushed their daughter from birth to be the best, achieve the best, but most importantly, marry the best. Their daughter had rebelled and married a poor kid with no family except a crazy mother and a criminal brother.
"Nice place you've got here, Mitch," Mr. Sutherland said in an effort to break the ice.
They sat for lunch and began passing dishes.
"Thanks."
"Nothing else. Just thanks." He concentrated on the food. There would be no smiles from him at lunch. The less he said, the more uncomfortable they would be. He wanted them to feel awkward, guilty, wrong. He wanted them to sweat, to bleed. It had been their decision to boycott the wedding. It had been their stones cast, not his.
"Everything is so lovely," her mother gushed in his direction.
"Thanks."
"We're so proud of it, Mother," Abby said.
The conversation immediately went to the remodeling. The men ate in silence as the women chattered on and on about what the decorator did to this room and that one. At times, Abby was almost desperate to fill in the gaps with words about whatever came to mind. Mitch almost felt sorry for her, but he kept his eyes on the table. The butter knife could have cut the tension.
"So you found a job?" Mrs. Sutherland asked.
"Yes, I start a week from Monday. I'll be teaching third graders at St. Andrew's Episcopal School."
"Teaching doesn't pay much," her father blurted.
"He's relentless," thought Mitch. "I'm not concerned with money, Dad. I'm a teacher. To me, it's the most important profession in the world. If I wanted money, I would have gone to medical school."
"Third graders," her mother said. "That's such a cute age. You'll be wanting children before long."
Mitch had already decided that if anything would attract these people to Memphis on a regular basis, it was grandchildren. And he had decided he could wait a long time. He had never been around children. There were no nieces or nephews, except for maybe a few unknown ones Ray had scattered around the country. And he had developed no affinity for children.
"Maybe in a few years, Mother."
"Maybe after they're both dead," thought Mitch.
"You want children, don't you, Mitch?" asked the mother-in-law.
"Maybe in a few years."
Mr. Sutherland pushed his plate away and lit a cigarette. The issue of smoking had been repeatedly discussed in the days before the visit. Mitch wanted it banned completely from his house, especially by these people. They had argued vehemently, and Abby won.
"How was the bar exam?" the father-in-law asked.
This could be interesting, Mitch thought.
"Grueling."
Abby chewed her food nervously.
"Do you think you passed?"
"I hope so."
"When will you know?"
4 to 6 weeks.
"How long did it last?"
4 days.
"He's done nothing but study and work since we moved here. I haven't seen much of him this summer," Abby said.
Mitch smiled at his wife. The time away from home was already a sore subject, and it was amusing to hear her condone it.
"What happens if you don't pass it?" her father asked.
"I don't know. I haven't thought about it."
"Do they give you a raise when you pass?"
Mitch decided to be nice, as he had promised. But it was difficult.
"Yes, a nice raise and a nice bonus." "How many lawyers are in the firm?"
40.
"My goodness," said Mrs. Sutherland. She lit up one of hers. "There's not that many in Dane County." "Where's your office?" he asked.
"Downtown."
"Can we see it?" she asked.
"Maybe some other time. It's closed to visitors on Saturdays."
Mitch amused himself with his answer. "Closed to visitors, as if it was a museum." Abby sensed disaster and began talking about the church they had joined. It had 4,000 members, a gymnasium, and bowling alley. She sang in the choir and taught 8-year-olds in Sunday school. Mitch went when he was not working, but
He'd been working most Sundays.
"I'm happy to see you found a church home, Abby," her father said piously. For years he had led the prayer each Sunday at the First Methodist Church in Danesboro, and the other 6 days he had tirelessly practiced greed and manipulation. He had also steadily but discreetly pursued whiskey and women. An awkward silence followed as the conversation came to a halt. He lit another one. "Keep smoking, old boy," Mitch thought. "Keep smoking."
"Let's have dessert on the patio," Abby said. She began clearing the table.
They bragged about his gardening skills, and he accepted the credit. The same kid down the street had pruned the trees, pulled the weeds, trimmed the hedges, and edged the patio. Mitch was proficient only in pulling weeds and scooping dog crap. He could also operate the lawn sprinkler, but usually let Mr. Rice do it. Abby served strawberry shortcake and coffee. She looked helplessly at her husband, but he was noncommittal.
"This is a real nice place you've got here," her father said for the third time as he surveyed the backyard.
Mitch could see his mind working. He had taken the measure of the house and neighborhood, and the curiosity was becoming unbearable.
"How much did the place cost, damn it?"
That's what he wanted to know.
"How much down? How much a month? Everything."
He would keep pecking away until he could work in the question somewhere.
"This is a lovely place," her mother said for the 10th time.
"When was it built?" her father asked.
Mitch laid his plate on the table and cleared his throat. He could sense it coming.
"It's about 15 years old," he answered.
"How many square feet?"
"About 3,000, Abby answered nervously.
Mitch glared at her. His composure was vanishing.
"It's a lovely neighborhood," her mother added helpfully.
"New loan? Or did you assume one?" her father asked, as if he were interviewing a loan applicant with weak collateral.
"It's a new loan," Mitch said, then waited. Abby waited and prayed.
He didn't wait, couldn't wait. "What did you pay for it?"
Mitch breathed deeply and was about to say, "Too much." Abby was quicker.
"We didn't pay too much, Daddy," she said firmly, with a frown. "We're quite capable of handling our money."
Mitch managed a smile while biting his tongue.
Mrs. Sutherland was on her feet. "Let's go for a drive, shall we? I want to see the river and that new pyramid they've built beside it. Shall we? Come on, Harold."
Harold wanted more information about the house, but his wife was now tugging on his arm.
"Great idea," Abby said.
They loaded into the shiny new BMW and went to see the river. Abby asked them not to smoke in the new car. Mitch drove in silence and tried to be nice.
Chapter 11. Nina entered the office in a rush with a stack of paperwork and laid it before her boss.
"I need signatures," she demanded, and handed him his pen.
"What is all this?" Mitch asked as he dutifully scribbled his name.
"Don't ask, just trust me.
I found a misspelled word in the Landmark Partners Agreement."
"It's the computer."
"Okay, get the computer fixed.
How late are you working tonight?"
Mitch scanned the documents and signed off on each.
"I don't know.
Why?"
"You look tired. Why don't you go home early, say around 10 or 10:30, and get some rest? Your eyes are beginning to look like Nathan Locke's."
"Very funny."
"Your wife called."
"I'll call her in a minute." When he finished, she restacked the letters and documents.
"It's 5 o'clock. I'm leaving. Oliver Lambert is waiting on you in the first floor library."
"Oliver Lambert? Waiting on me?"
"That's what I said.
He called not more than 5 minutes ago, said it was very important.
Mitch straightened his tie and ran down the hall, down the stairs, and walked casually into the library. Lambert, Avery,